Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. We've got a really, really exciting one for you today. We've got three fantastic authors. We're going to hear a little bit later on from Olivia Lang, who's got a book out, The Trip to Echo Spring. And it's an examination of why a certain generation of authors drank a lot and why that maybe wasn't such a good thing for them. We spoke to Pedro Lenz and his translator, Donald McLaughlin, about Pedro's book, Not Much of a Talker, which is a Swiss book which has been translated unusually into Scots. And we're going to start the podcast today with Sarah Hall. Sarah Hall was featured in Granta's list of best young British novelists, and we sit down to talk to her about her new collection of short stories called The Beautiful Indifference.
I'm Sarah Hall, and my latest book is The Beautiful Indifference, which is a collection of short stories. I'm going to read an extract from a story called She Murdered Mortal He, which is kind of a horror story in some ways. After a while, she turned and looked behind again. There was a white form a few hundred metres back down the beach where the path to the lodge began. His white linen shirt. Briefly, a sense of elation possessed her. He was looking for her, which meant he was worried. It meant a reversal, perhaps. Should she wait for him or walk on and let him make up the distance? Should she make it easy? She lingered a moment. No, this was his doing. He had instigated their division. He would have to catch up with her. She turned and walked on, not with haste but purposefully, her steps widening over the dry reefs, the flats of her sandals slapping the soles of her feet. Crabs scattered towards the water. She went about 30 paces, then she slowed. Perhaps he would not see her so far away. Her dress was pale. She might be indistinguishable against the sand. And she did want to be seen, didn't she? She paused, looked behind again. The white shape was in the same position, perhaps a little closer. She squinted. The surf was creating an illusory fog. The light was thickening. It was difficult to gain focus. She bridged her hands over her eyes. The shape was low to the ground and was not particularly large, not elongated like a man. It was not him. Her disappointment was simply confirmation. She knew he would not come. Still, she was annoyed to have hoped, to have permitted the minor fantasy. The white object was not large, but it was too big to be a seabird. Something mid-sized, then. It was definitely moving. It had velocity, a gait, but she could not tell in which direction it was heading, towards her or away. She peered along the corridor of sand. Towards her. It was coming towards her. She could make out a rocking motion, forwards and backwards, side to side. A creature loping or running. A spark of alarm fired across her chest. Suddenly, there was no air to breathe, though the beach was a cathedral of air. She stood still, lifted a hand to her mouth. A creature running towards her. A creature running towards her. She couldn't move, couldn't make a clear assessment. There were many dangers here, all outlined in the literature she had received from her health centre. Since arriving on the continent, she had retained a prudent fear of the environment. The disease, the bacteria, the wildlife. Not all of it could be washed away, contained, or immunised against. On the way to one of the game parks, they had passed an iron-roofed clinic. Outside, there had been a long queue of patients. A white doctor was leaning against the clinic wall, taking enormous, rushed bites out of a sandwich. On the road to the border, the traffic had suddenly stopped. After a minute or two, the cars ahead had pulled away and driven on, cautiously. A rhino was on the carriageway. It was grazing unspectacularly on the verge as they crawled past. Its plated torso was earth-coloured. Its eye was a tiny dark recess. 20 miles later, they had passed a woman in the middle of the road, waving her arms up and down. Then they'd seen the body, splayed, folded over itself, made boneless by impact. A young man, walking to work perhaps. The debris of his briefcase lay in the oncoming lane. It was everywhere, close to the surface, or rupturing through. She turned and walked on, quicker than before. She lengthened her stride. Whatever was behind her might simply have strayed onto the beach and would cut up into the brush again, leaving her alone. If it was following without motive or through curiosity, she could probably make it to the headland pass before it came too close. Just walk, she thought. Walk, don't run.
Have you ever been followed by dogs, wild dogs?
Yeah, this happened to me. This happened to me on a beach in Mozambique. This white creature loomed up out of the jungle, really, and came down the beach and started following and then caught up with us. I don't think it spoils the story to say that the thing turns out to be a stray dog. But for a while, she's got no idea what it is until it comes into focus. And this happened to me. And there was this, you know, terrible moment of panic. I'm not afraid of dogs. I've never been afraid of dogs. But you're in a foreign country and a kind of mangy stray comes up to you, and all of a sudden, you know, the paranoia kicks in and you start thinking, it's got rabies, it's going to attack me, this is it. And you kind of, you know, these fears that you have when you go abroad, some of them are justifiable and some of them are just, you know, a little bit of the kind of safe Western brain going, oh my God, I'm in trouble. And all of a sudden you're presented with it actually in the flesh of some creature. It's sort of the perfect, you know, clash of the being away and the safety being gone and having to confront what's actually out there in a foreign land.
That's something that seems like you're interested in. People who are living very comfortable lives, but there's this this underlying hum of tension. And I'm wondering where that comes from and why what your interest is in that.
We work so hard to create relatively safe lives. You know, that's what civilization does for us. There are all these mechanisms to keep us safe. But I'm actually not sure that that leads to happiness. It does lead to happiness on some levels, but I think there's an instinct in a lot of humans that you have to fight a bit more for something. You know, that idea that you have to run and kill something to get your food, to be fully satisfied by it. Going to the supermarket and doing a big shop might be nice at the time, but there's a kind of an underlying feeling of not having earned it enough. And so I am interested in these scenarios where, whether the characters know it or not, they are maybe subconsciously after something else, after that stroke of wildness, either externally or in themselves. One reading of this story suggests that this creature is a familiar. This woman has had an argument with her partner and they've split up and she's furious and she's walking along the beach and she's trying to actually kill this man off, already make him into an ex-boyfriend. And then this dog arrives and later in the story you realise that the dog might be involved in an attack. You're not quite sure. So in a way there's this secondary process going on with the character. She's, you know, she's trying to get over this guy and kill him off and actually, you know, on a kind of like supernatural level, he is being attacked by something at that point. So there's a sense of, you know, releasing the feral component in us and what that does and, you know, how it is somehow fulfilling in a very red, blunt, horrible, raw way. But somehow that can be more satisfying than, you know, the supermarket shop. Because, you know, we're still kind of biological creatures. We're maybe programmed a certain way. You know, the interactions are not all about passing the sugar bowl. You know, it's something else in us that affects us deeply and makes us act the way we do, particularly around love and sex and infidelity. You know, these are the areas where often the veneer of civilization kind of cracks. Everything goes wrong at these moments. People can't stop themselves. You know, we are monogamous, and in a way that's a kind of miracle, and it serves a purpose biologically, raising young, all the rest of it. But at the same time, they want to hunt. Women too, you know, you think women are kind of the ones that want to settle and a family life often, and that's true. But I do think there is that red streak in women as well, and that's what I'm very interested in the stories. I mean, everyone's interested in the drama and the sort of underbelly of life, no matter who they are. And I never underestimate an audience, because you just can't judge them. That's the earliest lesson I had from being published and starting to do readings and talking to readers and audiences. You just never know what appeals to people.
Why do you think you can write short stories well when you're on the road?
I mean, it's easy to bash something out in a first draft when you're travelling. It's much, much harder for me to kind of work on a novel, which needs a grand sense of continuity to it, and the idea of working on a chapter when I'm halfway around the world. And there's a kind of energy to travel that I think it's good for short stories. Episodes happen when you're traveling, and short stories can be quite episodic, and that suits them, I think. So what you kind of want is that strangeness and rawness, you know, because the short story reveals all that about life, the sort of ordinary. What seems to be ordinary suddenly becomes extraordinary. And to kind of get that on the page quite quickly when you've experienced it in travel is a good thing. I think there's a freshness to it. Things of a novel seem to have been metabolized a lot more and then set down. Putting a lens on something back home while you're away can also, you know, can also bring something to the work.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now?
Yep, I'm working on another novel, which is nearly finished, and it imagines a rewilding project in the UK, the reintroduction of grey wolves, in a self-sustaining enclosure, but it's large enough that it is a reintroduction scheme. So the main character is a woman called Rachel, born in Cumbria. She's been working in America on wolf projects in the Pacific Northwest. in Idaho and Yellowstone. And she's wooed back to the UK by a very rich earl who has a giant estate and has the land to set up this reintroduction scheme. And he does woo her back eventually, so she kind of oversees the project. But there's drama in the novel, so...
That sounds like a very nice story where nothing could possibly go wrong.
Right, what could go wrong? Wolves behind a giant fence. Let me think about this.
And does this come back to a little bit of a need for wildness?
Yeah, I suppose, again, it's an interest in the environment. The idea of national parks and land and wilderness. I mean, we don't really have wilderness left in the UK. The Highlands, you know, just about qualify, but not really. The Lake District doesn't. It's a kind of man-made zone at this point. It's still wild and people still get into trouble there, and it still has that sublime effect on people who come and visit. But we have a lot of control over the environment, you know, more so in Britain than in America, although America is a big industrialized nation. But there are genuine wildernesses left in North America in the way that we don't have them here. And we have a greater understanding of what's good for the environment now. You know, I think probably certain quarters always had that notion. But now we understand that apex predators are good and that a kind of diverse system in an environment keeps it healthy. So that with that kind of comes a responsibility. Sounds like Spider-Man. You know, if you are the custodians of the landscape, what does that mean? You know, how do you oversee it? How do you keep it healthy and diverse? There we are, multiculturalism in the environment.
Thanks, Sarah. The Beautiful Indifference is out now. I highly recommend everybody get a copy of it. It's a great, great collection of short stories. Up next, we have Pedro Lenz and his translator, Donald McLaughlin. Pedro Lenz writes in Swiss German, and in this conversation, we're going to talk about how these guys decided to translate this Swiss German novel into Glaswegian Scots. It's a really, really unique translation and a really exciting book and project.
My name is Pedro Lenz. I am from Switzerland, and I'm the author of Not Much of a Talker, which means Swiss German, der Goli bin ich.
I'm Donald McLaughlin, the translator of this novel.
It's about a guy who comes out from jail after 1 year, and he starts to settle his life in his hometown. He wants to be a new person. Then he falls in love with a waitress. Things began to be more complicated.
It all started long before that. I could just as well make out, but it all started that one evening, a few days after they let me out of the joke. But 10 in the evening it was, 10:30 maybe. And see, the wind would have cut right through you. Fucking freezing it was. Fog Valley, it November and all. My heart was a soaking wet flare cloth that was that heavy. So I takes myself into Cobbles, fancied a wee coffee I did, with a good shot of schnapps. The dosh they gie you when you leave the nick had already blown already. Not that I could have tell you wit on. So there I was, fuck all dosh, desperate for a coffee butt with schnapps in it, for a bit of company and all, a cunt or two to talk to. I'm telling you, aren't I, my pockets were empty, apart from a few fags, a few coins. Things were a bit tight-like, tighter than tight to be honest, waiting on money some cunt owed me I was. Try saying that butt when you're fresh out of the nick. I'm owed a whack of money, just don't have it yet. Impresses nae cunt that. So goes into Cobbles, like I say, and I order a coffee with schnapps. Regular asks, have I the money for it? Not a bad question, I admit. Do me a favour, Regia Giet, spare me the patter, bring me over the coffee just and we'll take it from there. Total patter merchant or what, she goes and fetches it. She's like that when she comes back, I didn't put it through, and she looks at me the one way, I don't know what way myself. Different anyhow, different from usual, with a bit more longing in her eyes or summat. I've nae idea what like it is for other guys. See me, but that kind of thing warms my heart, toasts my insides, it does. A woman like Reggie looking at me like that. Thanks, Reggie, love. You'll get your reward in heaven. The money and all sometime.
What an amazing translation and what an amazing start to a novel. Where did you find that voice, Pedro, for this character, Goli?
Diese Stimme oder dieser Sound.
Pedro heard voices like this kind of sound and language already in his youth. Despite that, it took him a long time when it came to writing the novel to actually finding the sound and finding a way of putting that voice down on the page.
Because when I heard this, it immediately reminded me of like that opening of How Late It Was, How Late by Kelman. And I was really, maybe not surprised, but totally happy to read that was an influence on on your own work, Kelman and Tom Leonard and...
Pedro
spent 6 months here in 2005 on a residency, and he read people like James Kelman and Tom Leonard back then, and when he read, for example, How Late It Was, How Late by Jim, he just thought, my God, this character could be from my home village. Even the blind man in Jim's novel seemed very familiar to Pedro.
And were you surprised that people were writing... do people write in this vernacular, in Swiss German?
There was a limited tradition, an old tradition, but those were traditionalists really writing about the past. And what you didn't have in Swiss writing so much before was this focus on the urban and urban voices using urban forms of dialect.
And so that was eye-opening for you to read the Scottish literature, yeah?
Ganz genau.
Exactly, it was eye-opening for Pedro. In reading James Kelman and other such writers, he realized that these colleagues were allowing themselves the freedom to let their characters speak on the page in the way they would in everyday life. So any redundancies, any repetitions, any false starts that you might have in everyday conversation, whatever level of language they use, Pedro saw from the work of Kelman and so on that it is legitimate and possible to put that down on the page.
Without people reading literature about these kinds of characters and in the language of the way they speak and actually having vivid real portraits of actual people, does it feel like they don't exist? Were you aware that these characters were out there?
Pedro says that, in fact, in literature, you always have found these characters in the work of Steinbeck, for example. But the problem is, in existing literature, very often they were secondary characters, not the main characters. Yeah, so the characters weren't given a voice in the way that they are now in the work of James Kelman or in Pedro's own novel. The other thing he wanted to stress is, nowadays, in this globalized world, a lot of novels are being written where the artists themselves are globalized, where the characters are globalized, and they're rather privileged from a higher level in society, and they travel this globalized world, and the type of character that Pedro is interested in is not reflected in that type of work.
What's inside of you that connects you yourself to them and gives you the empathy and the ability to tell their stories?
The fact that Pedro can write about these characters has a lot to do with his own background and the way he grew up. In fact, you know, he did go to a grammar school, and I guess the family expectation was that he would do his school leaving exams and go on to university and so on. Instead, he left school at the age of 16 and worked for 7 years as a bricklayer on a building site, and that opened his eyes to other types of fellow human being.
That must have been amazing. Do you remember the first days of working on the building site? Because the brief times I've ever done manual labor, I've always felt really insecure.
It's
funny, Pedro remembers very clearly his first day at work on the building site. His father, as everyone knew in the small village where he lived, was the manager of a factory. And on his first day at work, he was asked to carry bags of cement up to the fourth floor of a building. So all day he carried these heavy bags, and at the end of the day, his fellow workers turned around and said, "We had a crane, you know, we could have used the crane all along."
That's exactly my experience of working with these guys.
I was so slim. I had not one muscle on my body. So, but I had a sehr starken Willen. Yeah.
He showed in this way that he's very determined. He might not have had a muscle on his body. He was extremely thin even then, but he demonstrated his willpower at least.
And this you stay in this job and you begin to make friends. Did you feel like an outsider?
At the beginning, Pedro did feel like a complete and utter outsider, and he says that even if you read a newspaper that wasn't a tabloid, you were regarded as an intellectual arsehole. Things did improve, however, as time passed, because his fellow workers could see that he took his work seriously, that his craft mattered to him, and so he came to be accepted more and more.
I guess it comes down to this notion of maybe dignity or work ethic.
Absolutely, work ethic is something that's very important to Pedro. And if he hears writer colleagues nowadays complaining about having to go to the airport at 9 in the morning for a flight, he thinks, what kind of a crybaby are you? Most ordinary people have to be at their workplace at 7 already.
Yeah, but of course we don't notice the people who have to be at their workplace at 7. We're walking right past them, you know, and it's like, they're not there, you know, and you can easily forget that there's all these people who are building our things and taking our trash out and cleaning our houses and cleaning our hotel rooms. And of course,
exactly.
The difference is that Pedro does see these people. And if a writer colleague complains, for example, that he's got a reading tonight at 7 o'clock and he doesn't really feel like it, Pedro basically says, "Oh, shut up, you know. If you were a bricklayer, no one would ask you whether you feel like doing your work today. You just have to turn up and get on with it. And no one will applaud you at the end of your shift for having done it, you know."
The translation and the voice of this character is such an important thing. I'm wondering how you settled on doing a translation that involved such a heavy Glaswegian dialect. Was there a debate between the two of you of how to do this, or was it very natural and very instinctive as soon as you read the writing in German?
I would say it was very natural, very instinctive, a very obvious thing to do. But I'm talking there in terms of, you know, 2012, 2013. In fact, the two of us know each other, have known each other since 2005 now, having both been part of a writer's exchange initially between the cities of Glasgow and Bern. I spent 6 months in Switzerland, just as Pedro spent 6 months in Glasgow. And what I would say is, back then, especially when Pedro came to Glasgow, I translated some of his early work, short poems, monologues, and so on. And something clicked back then. We did bilingual readings back then, and it was obvious what was working and what appealed to audiences and so on. Pedro has described how he benefited from that residency, and that's reflected ultimately in this novel. He hadn't written a novel like this previously. It, in a way, grew out of his experience in Glasgow. So it seems entirely appropriate to me, obvious to me, natural to me, to produce a translation in that vernacular. Pedro would insist that in terms of his original novel, and even when it comes to my translation, neither of us are that interested actually in what he calls the dialect police. The crucial thing was to do our job, do our work, and do it well.
It seems very obvious that you've had to bring so much of your own self into it and had to do so much work in terms of making this translation. It's not a literal translation, it's not a dictionary translation. It seems very fresh and very real and very honest. But it's also your book in a way, is it?
Yeah, that's true. I think he did not a translation but a recreation and a rewriting of the book, yeah.
I guess it was a slightly different process from that characterizes other books that I have translated. I'm not sure how much of my own self I brought into it. You know?
Your own ear for rhythm, your own style, and these kind of things.
That absolutely. I mean, in terms of my own short stories, my own work is very coloured by the fact that at the age of 20, 21, I met Jim Kilman at a writer's workshop in Central Library in Paisley. And he got me reading a lot of great stuff that has informed all of my work, whether it be as a translator or as a writer or teaching and stuff that I did previously, yeah? All of that is informed by stuff I began to read thanks to Jim back then. And I wouldn't have been able to translate Pedro's novel had I not been reading and rereading Jim's own work from Not Not While the Gyro onwards as it appeared, and the many other colleagues whose work he introduced me to at the time, and the many writers that I heard reading at events in Glasgow throughout the 80s, Edinburgh in the 90s. All of that informs my work. All of that feeds into this translation of Pedro's work. Pedro has read many translations himself in the course of the years, and he's often sensed that the translation in question might be very faithful, but it's not poetic. And for him, the important thing is, in a translation of his work, that the natural poetry of his characters comes across. And he says, you know, a junkie in his everyday speech might very well be naturally poetic, and what Pedro wants to see in a translation is that poetry in the language of the character, even if that comes at the expense of faithfulness. The translator might not be as faithful to the original in the strictest sense as he or she might be, but for Pedro what counts is that the poetry comes across.
Thanks Pedro, thanks Donald. Not Much of a Talker is out now from Glasgow's own Freight Books. Get yourself a copy. The last guest on our podcast today is Olivia Lang. She's written a book called The Trip to Echo Spring, which is an examination of why some of our favorite authors drank so much. And these include people that I really love, like Ernest Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Raymond Carver. We had a very, very fascinating conversation about the need to drink and how helpful or hindering it is to drink so much as a writer. Here she is, Olivia Lang.
So I've written a book. The subtitle is Why Writers Drink. And what I wanted to do was examine that thorny subject by way of six writers. So I talk about Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, John Cheever, Raymond Carver, John Berryman, and Tennessee Williams. It's the story of their lives. It's also a story of a journey that I made across America from New York to Port Angeles by way of all kinds of other places. I wanted to build up a kind of topographical map of alcoholism. So I wanted to look at how alcoholism had affected their lives and how it had affected their work. I grew up in an alcoholic family myself, and I was always very intrigued. So at 17, studied A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof by Tennessee Williams. I was fascinated by this description of an alcoholic family. I just thought, well, this is what I've been living inside. This is really astonishing. And I think that sort of sense that a writer could describe something in a way that nobody I was ever going to encounter in the street was going to do, it just sort of stayed with me. And when I came to thinking about the second book I wanted to write, it was very clear immediately that this was it, that I wanted to think about alcohol, I wanted to think about alcoholism, I wanted to think about the way it had affected writers and the way that it was presented in their books. And I also just wanted to sort of pull away at that myth, that pervasive myth, that writers have a healthy relationship with alcohol, or that it's kind of groovy or creative. I wanted to see what the reality was, what the price they were paying was. John Berryman killed himself, Hemingway killed himself, Fitzgerald died at 40, a husk of a man, really. Tennessee Williams managed to live a longer life, but a pretty raddled life. And he died in terribly absurd, tragic circumstances, choking on a bottle cap from his eye drops in a hotel room, which is clearly related to the kind of intoxicated life he'd lived. I think alcoholism was decreative in many ways. It cost marriages, it cost relationships with children, it exerted a huge amount from all of them.
I always think of it like in an alcoholic family or situation, you know, there's that quietude, there's that secret, and then that's what writing kind of addresses in a way. Mm-hmm. And that's especially Carver's sort of like say it but don't say it, that kind of method of writing.
Yeah.
I feel like could only come from a total alcoholic.
That is really interesting, because I hadn't actually thought that that has its stylistic parallel, but of course it does in Hemingway and in Carver. That's something I hadn't thought before. The drinking would be the kind of, I'm cutting loose, it's done, the day's work is done. So it was part of a pattern, part of a productive pattern initially. As time went on, a less productive pattern, but it wasn't directly inspiring of his work. He didn't directly write drunk. Most of them tended not to. Even Tennessee Williams, who drank an awful lot, tended to write first thing in the morning with his black coffee before he'd start the sort of the wine and the second ales and the speed injections and the rest of the sort of crazy routine. So at some points I'd go through Tennessee Williams' journals, which are absolutely vast, and just read what he'd take in a day and totally knock you out tranquilizers and then like five martinis and then a couple of bottles of wine and all over the place. I mean, there's a school of thought now that says they're very avant-garde and they're very exciting, but to my mind, they're pretty unreadable. They're pretty addled. They're pretty confused. And he felt that. He felt that he was writing things that were very confused.
You told this great thing about Carver and Cheever hanging out in Iowa.
This is the story that the book starts with. And I suppose I was kind of trying to tell the myth before I started really like working away at it. So they both rock up at Iowa. At this point, Cheever is at a late stage in his career. So he's very much the successful writer. He's very much you know, the sort of waspy figure in his Brooks Brothers shirt and his tweed jacket, all like very rumpled, and, you know, he's high class. And Carver is young, he's blue collar, his father was a mill worker, he is very poor, he's got a couple of kids, and he's kind of come away from his family who are in California, so he's up there on his own. And they're put in this kind of hotel. It's not a hotel, but it's kind of, it looks like a hotel, it might as well be a hotel. And he's just arrived, and there's this knock at the door, and he opens it, and there is John Cheever, his hero. And John Cheever says, I say, might I trouble you for a drink? In his practice, I mean, his voice is extraordinary. He does sound British at that point. And Carver's like, it's John Cheever. He wants booze. And he sort of stutteringly indicates this massive bottle of vodka that he's got, and they just... there it is, you know, they just know that they've got an ally there. and Cheva takes it. He says, oh no, I don't want any ice. I don't want any juice. Just take the vodka, thanks. You know, so he sort of knocks that back. And from then on for this year, where they're both kind of out of time, away from their families, they just drink. They hang out in the mill bar and they drink. And Carver has a car, thank God, because Cheva doesn't have a car. So Carver is driving them to the liquor store, the state liquor store, where Cheva will literally jump out of the car while it's still moving in order to run in at 10 a.m. as the clerk's turning the key in the door. So this is the sort of desperation of his drinking at that point. And in fact, after Carver leaves, and I don't tell this sort of part of the story until much later in the book, but after Carver leaves, Cheva basically starts drinking himself to death. And in the end, his brother has to come and rescue him and take him to a drying out place because he can no longer function in any way. He can barely speak, let alone teach a class. So it's really this sort of turning point.
Did they get anything done?
No, of course they didn't get anything done. They taught their classes. I mean, they stood in front of their classes. And probably some people found them really inspiring. Probably they were very funny. But Carver says afterwards in a Paris Review interview, we didn't take our covers off our typewriters. And John Updike, who was also around on campus at the time, says, in fact, there's a funny story about that as well, because Updike comes, he and Cheva are going out on some, I don't know, for a meal or something, and he turns up, and as he arrives in the corridor, Cheva comes reeling out stark naked, closes the door behind him, and is then locked out of his apartment. So Updike has to wrangle this kind of naked 60-year-old who's out of his mind. I'm laughing, but it really, it's not a funny story.
That's the tragic thing, because these are funny stories, and it's exactly like all the times we almost all killed ourselves because we drank way too much. Yeah. Which is funny, and if you're a parent or you look back at it, you're like, I definitely should not have done that.
Yeah. And I think the funny thing as well, it's interesting, Updike didn't really find it that funny. You know, he was a kind of sober guy and he was like, this is disgusting. What are you doing? And Cheva's got three kids and a wife and not happy relationships with any of them. So the costs of it all are very, very high. And I think that's the thing. I wanted to keep that sort of levity, but at the same time, I really wanted to unpick it and see, well, what did that cost?
I don't know. I guess you can't say, oh, they'd be better writers if they didn't have the chaos that they created themselves.
I think they would have been better writers. And I think often they felt that themselves, that it is not creative. The first 5 years potentially are creative and fun, but late stage alcoholism is not in any way creative. Nobody who is in late stage alcoholism was writing anything. Cheva didn't write Faulkner. He had the first line of Faulkner on his typewriter that whole year. He couldn't write the second sentence. He couldn't write the second sentence until he was sober. So if you think of the unwritten books that were lost because of that, I think that's a really sobering thought in itself.
Olivia Lang, everybody. Her book, The Trip to Echo Spring, is available now. Check it out. Thanks again to her, as well as to Pedro Lenz, Donna McLaughlin, and Sarah Hall, all of whom were amazing. It's been such a great podcast today. I'm really appreciative of all of these guests who joined us. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed our podcast, don't forget to subscribe via iTunes. And if you want to find out more about the Scottish Book Trust and what we do, visit us on scottishbooktrust.com or like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at ScottishBKTrust. It's been an absolute pleasure being in your ears today, and we'll be back with you again soon. Until then, goodbye for now. Book Talked is produced by Colin Fraser with music from Ragland.